Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
We welcome you again to the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, Chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University, the host of our program, Past Impressions, where we study the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and examine with some of the best scholars and historians of the Church issues, people, places, events associated with the history of the Church. We're honored today to have on our program Robin Jensen, project archivist associated with the Joseph Smith Papers Project in the LDS Church History Department. We're pleased to have Robin with us today to talk about some of the important events associated with the succession crisis at the death of the Prophet Joseph. And so, Robin, thank you so much for being our guest.
It's good to be here.
Robin, why don't we pick up with the death of the Prophet Joseph Smith. We've talked about the events associated with the martyrdom and the events leading up to the martyrdom, but now let's talk about a little different dimension, and that is the leadership crisis and what happens to the saints, to the leaders, what happens to this whole notion of who's going to lead us now at that point.
Yeah. We often look back on this time period with our own understanding. We've experienced the death of several prophets, and we know how it works. The prophet dies. The Quorum of the Twelve take leadership among those 12. They appoint the senior member as prophet. We know how it works. There's a precedent. What we need to remember is that the early saints did not have this experience. Joseph Smith was the prophet. He was the prophet of the Restoration. And so when he tragically died on that day, June 27, 1844, there was no precedent. They didn't understand. They didn't have this history to look back on. And so many individuals had to turn to past sayings of Joseph Smith, the revelations, and it was open for interpretation for some individuals. So I'd like to stress the fact that these individuals didn't have the understanding that we do today. What's important to realize is that on the day Joseph Smith died, he and Hiram Smith were at Carthage Jail. They died, but also was Willard Richards and John Taylor, two of the 12 apostles. The remainder of the apostles were out on missionary work. Mm-hmm. Joseph Smith was recently put forward as a presidential candidate, and the church surprisingly sent out a large amount of missionary elders to support not only Joseph Smith's presidential candidacy, but also to spread the gospel. In fact, in April of 1844, there were about 300 missionaries that were newly called and sent out across the country. And the Quorum of the Twelve appointed close to 50 conferences that they were going to hold from May to September of 1844. So there was this grand mission movement when Joseph Smith died. So this interrupted that emphasis, and the Quorum of the Twelve rushed back to Nauvoo to comfort the saints, to be comforted among their quorum and to see what was going on.
How quickly after the death did the 12 get the word that Joseph was killed?
Yeah, well, that is an important point. The 19th century was not like the 21st century where Twitter and Facebook statuses prevail. It took them several weeks to even hear of the news of the death. And some of the earliest reports were published in non-Mormon newspapers, and there are some that refused to believe it. They thought that it was false reports. In fact, Joseph Smith was reported to have died earlier. And so they rightly were cautious of the news. But when they finally heard that it was indeed true, they were rightly upset and then rushed back to Nauvoo. So the church leadership in 1844 was seen as different than today. We today realize that Mormonism is continuing revelation, that Mormonism, the aspects of Mormonism, one of the elements of current-day Mormonism is continuing revelation. And so we understand that leadership and positions and how that's seen has shifted throughout history. At the time of Joseph Smith's death, there were three quorums that many individuals looked to for guidance. The Quorum of the Twelve was one of them. The other one was the First Presidency and the High Council. The First Presidency, we understand, that was Joseph Smith, Hiram Smith, and Sidney Rigdon, and then others were a member of that quorum. They did not, again, have this precedent of understanding that the First Presidency dissolved mm-hmm. when the prophet died. So many individuals looked to the remainder of the First Presidency, or Sidney Rigdon, as someone to look to for guidance, leadership. The High Council actually is an interesting quorum. We don't have that today, but the Nauvoo High Council was more than just a stake High Council. In fact, about a month before Joseph Smith died, the Nauvoo High Council overviewed a case dealing with an individual in New Orleans. So they're hearing cases of the entire church. Mm-hmm. And so it's rightly members rightly looked to the High Council for guidance for stake, not only stake, but church-wide matters. So what we have at the death of Joseph Smith, we have essentially three quorums in which individuals looked for leadership, guidance, and it was a confusing time.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about how the Quorum of the Twelve come to take a more prominent role in that, and let's talk about the events that lead up to the succession of Brigham Young.
Sure. So Sidney Rigdon was came on the scene in Nauvoo before Brigham Young and the majority of the Twelve. He came into Nauvoo. He was rightly distraught, sad, and saints rightly looked to him for guidance. On the beginning of August, August 4th, I believe, he interrupted a meeting and said that there would be a meeting held on August 8th in which they would appoint a guardian for the church, someone to watch over the church. This was when he called for this announcement before Brigham Young was in Nauvoo, before the president of the mm-hmm. Quorum of the Twelve was in Nauvoo. Some saints felt that was rushing things, but Sidney Rigdon claimed to have seen a vision wherein he saw Joseph Smith ascend to heaven and that he, Sidney Rigdon, would be the guardian of the church. Well, what happened, Brigham Young did come to Nauvoo before the August 8th meeting. So August 8th comes around and there was this meeting appointed. Brigham Young opened this meeting. Well, I should say, for the majority of the saints, the church, the report of this meeting came in the issue of the Times and Seasons. Mm-hmm. We forget that only a percentage of the church actually lived in Nauvoo. There were a lot of members outside of Nauvoo who were, I can only imagine, wondering what was going mm-hmm. on, what news was there from Nauvoo. And this issue of the Times and Seasons is important because it gives a brief summary of this meeting. And so in this issue of the Times and Seasons, Brigham Young is said that while the prophet lived, we walked by sight. He is taken from us and we must now walk by faith. Hmm. So you can get a sense of the confusion and the not quite sure where they need to go. When Brigham Young opened up the meeting on August 8th, he asked, "I am going to ask if you want Sidney Rigdon or Amasa Lyman." Amasa Lyman mm-hmm. was also a member of the First Presidency. "To be the First Presidency, you are welcome to them, but you cannot put them above the Twelve. Brother Rigdon and Brother Lyman were at Joseph Smith's side, not above. No man has a right to counsel the Twelve but Joseph Smith. If you let the Twelve remain, the keys of the kingdom are in them, and you cannot pluck it out. We have an organization that you have not seen. Now, all this does not lessen the character of President Rigdon or Lyman. Let them magnify their calling, and Joseph will want them beyond the veil. Let them be careful what they do, that they will not sever the thread." There's this interesting theme of both Sidney Rigdon and Brigham Young, that Joseph Smith was still to lead the church beyond mm-hmm. the veil, mm-hmm. that Joseph Smith as president of the church was not to be replaced, that the Quorum of the Twelve would lead the church under their capacity as Quorum of the Twelve, or that Sidney Rigdon would lead the church as a capacity of guardian. But no one really presented at this time, no one really presented the idea that someone would actually replace the office of president and prophet of the church. It's an interesting element that we don't see today when the prophet dies.
I have a question for you there. When Brigham, that really important statement where he says, you can have these brethren, but they'll have to be appointed by the 12. Brigham makes some very strong statements about the 12 being the key holders.
Yep.
Was that familiar to the saints? Now, we've talked about how familiar that is to us, and it just is
sure.
second nature to
sure.
us. Had the saints been taught about the role of the 12?
That's an interesting question. And again, I think it leads us to this division of the church members in Nauvoo and outside of Nauvoo. Mm-hmm. I would estimate that most members outside of Nauvoo only had access to the times and seasons, to the Doctrine and Covenants, these types of material, and they were not familiar with the evolving nature of the Quorum of the Twelve. The saints in Nauvoo saw the increasing role that the 12 played with the leadership.
What would be some of those things that the 12 did that would demonstrate that Joseph was putting greater and greater responsibility upon them?
It was everything from appointing missionaries for the church, transacting business for the church, and then while not as visible, many people saw the temple and the ordinances going on in the temple as coming from the Quorum of the Twelve. Joseph Smith placed increasing trust on the 12, gave them the keys of the authority of the temple. And that eventually, not at this meeting explicitly, but eventually Brigham Young and the Quorum of the 12 would make that argument that if the saints want the blessings of the temple, they need to follow the 12.
Now that is a really interesting idea, and I think it also is further compounded by the fact that Sidney hasn't been as visible as the 12. Why don't you share with us why not?
Yeah, so Sidney Rigdon was baptized in late 1830, the same year the church was organized. He played a key role in the church's history from almost its infancy. And what's interesting, and I find a little sad, he got really sick in 1839. They traveled to Washington, D.C., and he was waylaid and mm-hmm. had to stay there for months. And when he returned to Nauvoo, he still felt very ill. His health was quite poor. And I think there was a little bit of practicality. Joseph Smith had to rely on other people, and Sidney Rigdon needed to take care of his health. And then in 1842 and 1843, there were problems with Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon. Joseph Smith thought that Rigdon was in association with John C. Bennett mm-hmm. after he left the church. And so there was this rift between Joseph and Sidney Rigdon. And I think Joseph Smith simply turned away from Rigdon and turned to the 12 in order to get things done within the church.
Today on Past Impressions, we're talking with Robin Jensen, project archivist in the Joseph Smith Papers Projects. We're talking about what some scholars call the succession crisis at the death of the prophet Joseph, who's going to be the leader of the church. And Robin, you've talked to us about what we might call competing claims of leadership, First Presidency, Quorum of the Twelve, and High Council. We talked about Sidney Rigdon in the First Presidency wanting to be guardian, Amasa Lyman as a claim also that we'll talk about, then Brigham Young talking about the role of the 12. We also have an interesting claimant there, and that's William Marks and his claim. Why don't you just share with us briefly about William Marks and then how all of these come together in having to make a decision? The saints, how are they going to make the decision?
There's an interesting case with Marx. With Rigdon, there's this ambition and this desire to watch over the saints. With Brigham Young and the 12, there seems to be this unity among the 12, which goes back clear back into the mission in England in 1839 and 40, where it's a unified body. Marx, as over the High Council of Nauvoo, there's not that unity among the High Council. It's kind of this body that evolves. People go in and out. And Marx doesn't seem to have the ambition or the desire to take over the leadership of the 12 or of the church. He seems to simply follow others. He mm-hmm. he talks about following Rigdon. That he seems to be a little bit more observant rather than an actor in the mm-hmm. history. I know that there are some that put his name forward, including Emma Smith.
Right.
But he just seemed not to want it.
Right.
He for whatever reason, whether it was personality or whether he understood his own understanding of the doctrine or hierarchy, he didn't want it.
It is interesting, though, that some have claimed that Emma was pushing him forward because of her feelings that he would cease the practice of plural marriage, and
sure.
that was one of the moving forces there. While we can't be completely sure on that, but
and I think there's an element of personalities, and we'll talk about this a little bit later. But there really is. If you don't like someone, then you're not going to follow them. And
right.
there were some that didn't like Brigham Young. There were some that didn't like Sidney Rigdon. And that surprisingly played into whether to follow them or not.
Yeah, and that's going to play a really important role in our next program when we talk about even other groups that are not as familiar
yep.
To us. Well, let's talk about that really significant August 8th meeting. You shared with us a wonderful statement from Brigham Young about kind of setting the ground rules for the discussion. Let's talk about what actually goes on in the meeting and what happens.
So we talk about it today as this wonderful event wherein so many members of the church see the mantle of Joseph mm-hmm. Smith fall upon Brigham Young. As a historian looking back on that, it's surprising to note that there are no contemporary documents that describe that event, that there was a physical or spiritual transformation of Brigham Young speaking as if in the voice or in the persona of Joseph Smith. It's an interesting twist where a historian tries not to go into the spiritual side of things, and so it to me remains interesting, noteworthy that contemporaneously that did not seem to be recorded. What was recorded, and as I mentioned before, what was found in the Times and Seasons, was the argument, the doctrinal argument that the Quorum of the Twelve should be leaders of the church, that Joseph Smith, as the president, prophet of the church, went beyond the veil, and he still directed and guided the Quorum of the Twelve. And what eventually happened is Brigham Young called for a vote. He asked for a vote of the saints who they would support. And actually, Sidney Rigdon withdrew his own name. Mm-hmm. And so it was essentially Brigham Young saying, Sidney Rigdon has withdrawn his name. Will you follow the 12? And there's this great statement in the original minutes that said that Brigham Young says, and if you vote for us, I don't want to hear you murmur at later, which maybe provides a little bit of foreshadowing of the tribulation and trial that they would suffer in going to Utah and the Exodus and following Brigham Young.
Do we have any historical record that Sidney argued from a Keyes standpoint? Because the Doctrine and Covenants also tells us that the first presidency held the Keyes. And yes, the prophet Joseph Smith ultimately says, where I am not, there is no first presidency. But was there anything that Sidney argued that, no, the Keyes belong with us?
The Keyes, the statement of Keyes is an interesting phenomenon. I think the Quorum of the Twelve understood the Keyes to be with the temple, mm-hmm. Priesthood authority to act in the temple. Rigdon would not have seen the Keyes as that same sense. He would have seen Keyes as the authority to act over the church in the Quorum of the First Presidency. So it's interesting how the succession crisis, as it's as called, often comes down to the actual ordinances of the church, including the temple and plural marriage, the authority to do some of these ordinances that Joseph Smith first introduced.
Interesting. Well, that's great. So what happens then after he presents that, and is it totally unanimous? Is there
the minutes published in the Times and Seasons says that it's unanimous, but clearly it was not mm-hmm. As far as people actually following Brigham Young. There were many people in Nauvoo that looked elsewhere. They for whatever reason, maybe they were seeing the writing on the wall, they did not feel up to yet another move. Remember, the church had moved mm-hmm. from state to state. And following Brigham Young was a life decision. It was a lifetime commitment. And some of the saints, for practical reasons and for theological reasons that we can explain later, were not willing to go there.
Robin, as we talked about that important August 8th meeting where Brigham Young's leadership is sustained by the members of the church, you mentioned that the times and seasons and the other contemporary accounts do not record the events of what we call the transfiguration of Brigham Young. Why don't you share with us where those accounts come from and how do they become so pronounced in our Latter-day Saint literature today?
It's an interesting phenomenon as a historian to look at these accounts because they are reminiscences. Many individuals later in their life write about the fact that they saw Brigham Young and yet heard Joseph Smith's voice, or they saw Brigham Young and then all of a sudden they were seeing Joseph Smith as if they saw this spiritual manifestation, which to them convinced them that Brigham Young really was to be the successor of Joseph Smith. In the minutes of this August 8th meeting, Brigham Young says that the mantle of Elijah has fallen upon the Quorum of the Twelve, which again we've talked mm-hmm. about the temple ordinances and how they saw that as their role. And I think there's some element of this mantle, the keys, a mantle. It's very biblical. It's very mm-hmm. scriptural, falling upon the Twelve that was contemporaneously taught. There is this succession, this passage of keys to the Quorum of the Twelve. The reminiscences, however, of this spiritual manifestation of Brigham Young transforming into Joseph Smith, or his voice, mm-hmm. people hearing his voice and then hearing Joseph Smith's voice, come later in Utah when saints are at the point where they're dying off this first generation and they want to capture as a way of testifying to their posterity of the things that they've seen. And as historians, some historians see reminiscences as faulty or mm-hmm. somehow inaccurate or made up. And while that can be the case in some instances, the sheer number of reminiscences regarding this experience, to me personally as a historian, where there's smoke, there's fire.
Yeah, it's got to give some credibility to the accounts.
And you know, as a historian, it's impossible to document a spiritual experience, to mm-hmm. to document what someone experienced. And so I acknowledge the reminiscences, and I think for some individuals, there was a spiritual manifestation for them. Yeah. To completely jettison it, I think, is irresponsible as a historian.
Well, and I think that's very good comment about that being in the record, that the mantle of Elijah, that we know from the Old Testament that there was literally something that took place between yep. Elijah and Elisha. So, well, let's now talk about the decision is made. The saints have sustained Brigham Young and the Twelve. Now what happens? How does the church go forward from that point in August of 1844?
So shortly after the meeting, the Quorum of the Twelve write an epistle to the church. It's published in the Times and Seasons, which, as I said, was the main form of communication. And in it they say, "You are now without a prophet present with you in the flesh to guide you, but you are not without apostles who hold the keys of power to seal on earth that which shall be sealed in heaven, and to preside over all the affairs of the church in all the world, being still under the direction of the same God and being dictated by the same Spirit, having the same manifestations of the Holy Ghost to dictate all the affairs of the church in all the world." And they go on in this epistle to say the things that took place under Joseph Smith will continue to take place. We still need to gather to Nauvoo. It's a gathering place. We will still build the temple and perform the ordinances therein. So the Quorum of the Twelve provided this sense of continuity that they wanted mm-hmm. to say that the church is still running as it was. Joseph Smith is still at the head. We are still the Quorum of the Twelve, and we still want to enjoy the blessings of the gospel. And then, unfortunately, circumstances prevented them from fully enjoying their stay in Nauvoo. They sure. were shortly kicked out. In early 1846, the exodus began. Brigham Young, as president of the Quorum of the Twelve and as leader of the church, began the march west to Utah. And so, as I said earlier, the decision to follow Brigham Young was a life choice, and you were fully committed to Brigham Young.
Yeah. Now, we've talked about the other claims, and the August 8th meeting doesn't put an end to the claims, and we're going to talk about that in our next program. Maybe, Robin, just as we close this program today, why don't you share with us your feelings about these competing claims? Oftentimes we refer to them as apostates. How would you characterize the competing claims and Brigham Young?
I view these individuals with two hats. As a historian, I view these individuals as an important element in understanding what was difficult in Mormonism and what was fought over in Mormonism and how people identified as Mormons. As a believing member, I find it actually very powerful to know that even though someone could not follow Brigham Young for whatever reason, they could not let go of Mormonism. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's a testimony that Mormonism reaches the core and it changes you forever. And you, once you have that testimony and you're fully committed, it's very difficult to turn away from it.
That's a great statement. And in our next program, we will be talking about some of these other, what we might call schismatic groups, the Mormon tradition that moves on in a little different direction. And so we invite you to listen on our next program with Brother Robin Jensen of the Joseph Smith Papers Project as we continue talking about the succession crisis and the schismatic groups. You've been listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.